Great. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Ross and Lynn Johnson. And Bruce is here with me from wherever he happens to be. And where are you today, my dear brother Bruce?
Good morning, Lynn and all. I'm back in Oregon on the coast and had a good trip to California for a couple of weeks and now glad to be back. So,
very good. Welcome back. So, what's up with Bruce this week? Anything interesting going on?
Well, one of the conversations I thought might be appropriate, given that we're going into Labor Day weekend, would be to talk about work. So I found a few FAQs that I, I think I might have posted it in the other chat window. So let me paste some of those in there. The one that I thought might be interesting that I'm clicking at right now is 169. Let me just grab that one specifically from the facimoutreach.org. And I'll just put a little... There we go. Okay. There's a bunch of them. I just looked up work in the master index on the FAQ site, and there's a bunch of things about work. And so it's a pretty big topic. we all have special relationships to it, you know, just like to people and food and sex and money and all kinds of stuff in the world that, you know, we think control us, you know, that are essentially just areas of our mind that we've cordoned off and made into big deals that you know, Holy Spirit keeps saying, well, you know, you could address this too with your forgiveness practice.
And everything works and work. It doesn't matter who or what you are. I was just thinking about this last night, actually, contemplating that you're always in this world, you always have to be doing something for somebody that seems to be of a value to somebody in order to earn your keep, you know, in order to be worthy of having life. And, you know, that's a condition that the ego put on us. That's part of its control system, is this belief in lack that makes us think that we must do something in order to survive.
Right. And it's a sort of dependence. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
It's sort of the idea that we have to earn or learn or somehow merit something is sort of implicit in the ego's system of lack, which really is based on demerits, if you will. You know, in other words, the ego, knowing that it is nothing, knows that there's no worth to a fictitious, illusory thought system, and so it tries to make stuff up. You know, as Robin Williams says, I'll use a euphemistic version, is it puts stuff in the way, you know, because the whole premise of the ego is flawed. So in order to justify its existence, we think we need to justify our existence. You know, that takes the form of, the sense of duty or obligation or you know, the idea that we need to be loyal to, a workplace or to our country and none of these things are there's anything wrong with those things. It's just, when it's a sense of obligation rather than, a sense of joyous, you know, just a natural expression of appreciation and gratitude, then things get a little messed up, it would seem. So.
Well, yeah, anyway. It's a belief in doing and not being.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, we're in a state where, because of the way the ego has us set up into believing in lack and scarcity and smallness and powerlessness and all these things that we think we are, we're in a position where that's our entire reality. You know, it's very difficult, I think, for anyone, no matter what their belief system is, to believe that they are completely safe. And is like yesterday's lesson, I'm in no danger. I'm in danger nowhere in this world. You know, we look at the world and think that danger is everywhere. And the main source of that danger is lack, that we won't have enough, that we, you know, we fear for our, you know, existence because, you know, we don't think we have what we need. And so having and being are the same. It's, there's, you know, Jesus tells us all throughout the course that, that belief is erroneous. And it is that belief that is keeping us from, recognizing and realizing the truth about ourselves because we see ourselves so small. And, you know, how many times does he say, you know, wouldn't you rather, you know, fly with the wings of an eagle, you know, than that little sparrow? Why do you keep thinking you're so small? And yet, you know, I still think, ooh, I need to figure out a way to make a living. Nobody's going to take care of me if I don't. And it's all that misbelief in what we truly are that just keeps us on that cycle. It's crazy.
It is. It is. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting that when you find something, well, it's not even a thing. It's when you find a place in the mind that then sometimes reflects in activities and things that you just naturally find, you know, a reflection of the peace that's within you, then, you know, there's no sense of duty, obligation, or lack, or sacrifice, or, you know, that sort of thing. When you're in that flow, if you will, if you're in the spirit of appreciation and gratitude, it doesn't, you know, the idea of compensation and you know, when you're being and having and giving and receiving is all the same thing, there's no lack, which is true in spirit, because how could there be lack in perfect oneness? Then the whole whole ego thought system essentially is put on hold in that moment and in those moments. And so, I mean, I suppose that's, you know, part of the curriculum is really recognizing where we've, you know, in ways subtle and not so subtle, invested in, like you say, the really crazy beliefs that suggest that, you know, we have to do something or be something, you know, as an existence in the world as a separate self in order to, you know, atone in the world. But it's obviously never about the world. It's always about the mind in terms of the curriculum we're studying, aren't we? Yeah. So, anyway, should we read the FAQ? Or?
Sure, and I did post it in the room.
Okay.
It's FAQ number 169, uh-huh. And why don't you go ahead and read it.
Okay. It starts out, in the past, I've had problems in gaining employment. I used to think life was too short to work or money is not worth the time involved. I came to realize my excuses had to do with my inferiority complexes, shyness, inequality, etc., and I could not handle the expectations of an employer or social pressure within the workplace. Well, there's a couple things right there that probably pretty common for a lot of people, if, you know, just whether it's conscious or unconscious. Although I have made great advances with the Course in Miracles and with forgiveness, I can't seem to distinguish between ego or Holy Spirit with regard to employment. It seems that there is no point in working and I could devote my time to forgiveness. Or maybe by working, I could learn my biggest lesson of forgiveness. Now they're onto something. Which is ego? Which is Holy Spirit? This is a pretty good question. A lot of open-ended material here, huh?
And I'm just blown away, actually, by the naivete of this writer. First, because it appears they have a choice. Like, I could work or I don't have to work. And the consequences of working or not working, what would that be? And I'm thinking as you're reading it, well, the biggest forgiveness lesson of your life could be when you're sleeping under a bridge and there's a blizzard going on. Because you chose not to work. Not saying that that would happen, but it just seems so cute to me that, you know, people even can ask the question, you know, should I leave my home and family and go live on the top of a mountain? Should I quit my job? Should I move to Sedona? people thinking all these different things are required or would be helpful. And, you know, the idea of just doing anything other than what comes to you, it becomes absurd after a while. You just start seeing, oh, I didn't have to do that in the first place. Oh, I shouldn't have worried so much about these things that I thought were going to happen, and just live your life without all these stupid questions. But anyway, we've got this. Very rude of me to say that, but that is a kind of, you know, when you're in a, you have to be so privileged, I think, to be able to even speculate on these kind of questions, because most of us don't have that choice of, you know, or, you know, we have a family that we need to take care of, or, you know, whatever. So, you know, it's sweet. The question is sweet, but like I said, you know, who has that choice? Not many of us.
Which kind of ties immediately into the whole question of, you know, as the two thought systems that the Course suggests, only one of them really deals with victimhood. And it's so easy, it's so familiar, let us say, to jump into subtle and not so subtle forms of victimhood, and victimhood around obligations and work and chores, responsibilities, whether it's domestic or in a workplace or, you know, the whole gamut of stuff, you know, just the sense of it really, you know, I think is one of the deeper subjects in terms of, deep in terms of our typical investment in the world. I'm speaking in the first person here. It's so easy to get, you know, wrapped around the axle thinking that, well, there's stuff that I have to do in order to redeem myself. And we don't usually phrase it in that way consciously, but I think that there's, I think, you know, a tendency to make our peace contingent on some sort of performance in the world, or some sort of contribution, or some sort of, you know, effort. And it really is independent of that. Our intrinsic worth and our intrinsic being is totally independent of whatever we do or don't do in the world, because, as the Course points out, there is no world. This is the central thought the Course attempts to teach. So I think it's just basically another example of the pervasiveness of the ego in making the world. And you know, one of the cornerstones of the world is that you have to work, and there needs to be some sort of effort, or usually some kind of struggle, or sacrifice, or compromise, or, you know, something along those lines that reflects a lack or a loss, or an abandonment, or, you know, just something less than perfect peace involved in being in the world. And I think that's where the forgiveness classroom comes in, where we look at all those, you know, faulty investments, if you will, and see how those have not worked for us, and systematically, and, you know, in a very, you know, sort of an anti-developmental way, we undevelop ego by, you know, dismantling it brick by brick, so to speak, its prison, and using those same bricks to build a classroom, you know, and the bricks are sort of symbolic of the moments that where we have a lucid awareness that, well, ego's thought system is not working for us. You know, how's that working out for you? The Holy Spirit asks, and you know, our decision making mind in honesty has to say, not so great when I'm following ego, you know, and one of the main ways that we do that is by, you know, making our peace of mind contingent on anything in the world, including, achievements, checking things off of lists. I've got my hand raised high in the air here, which you can't see. You know, but, you know, it's interesting, you know, how we not only do we like to have enemies, because that gives us something to fight against, but I think on a more subtle level, sometimes the adversary that we have is ourself, in terms of thinking that there's something that we need to achieve, something we need to you know, some performance, or some contribution, or some you know, dedication, or effort, or, you know, the blood, sweat, and tears of everyday life that we think is necessary in order for us to be peaceful. And it kind of almost gets back to this, is Calvinistic the right word? Anyway, just, but, you know, a kind of a religious, fervor of thinking that there's got to be something in the world that I can do to redeem myself.
Yes.
But the underlying premise that we're not looking at is that the Course in Miracles suggests is that we're not afraid of salvation. We're afraid of redemption. And that's basically because if we really do find the redemption that the Holy Spirit offers 24/7, 365, then we're off the hook and everyone else is off the hook. And that's usually how we do it, by letting everyone else, including ourselves, off the hook. And that's what the whole nature of forgiveness is recognizing in truth, in spirit, in perfect oneness, nothing happened. And if that's the case, then we can actually afford to be infinitely gentle with ourselves and everyone else. And when we catch ourselves in those moments when we're not, you know, beating ourselves up for something we should have, could have, ought have done or didn't do, or or you know, something we did that we shouldn't have done, you know, all that kind of that whole realm of stuff, that becomes a huge part of our forgiveness classroom, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. And just the whole, what you mentioned, I think is absolutely the key, is I have to let my brother off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to really look at my brother and recognize that he did nothing wrong before I can do that for myself. I can never forgive myself as long as I'm blaming everything else and looking at everything else as if something has gone wrong. And so really coming to the point where I recognize nothing has gone wrong is the point of acceptance of whatever my state seems to be, and I can stop then fighting to or struggling to change the outcome of whatever happens to be happening. It takes an absolute even though the word surrender is not mentioned once in the Course in Miracles, letting go is releasing I mean, there's a lot of other words that Jesus uses that says, you know, stop trying to think for yourself. Stop trying to figure things out. Just stop doing what you're doing and let things be exactly as they are. Because when you can relax into that place where I'm in danger nowhere in this world, when I can relax into this place where I don't see myself being attacked on all sides by whatever seems to be going on, and instead I'm recognizing that the things that are coming to me are a part of my forgiveness classroom, and are directly reflective of my thoughts. There's not a single thing that comes to me that I can disown. There's not a thing that comes to me that I can say, well, that wasn't part of my thought system. If I look at anything that happens, I recognize that it's a direct reflection of my own thought system that is making this appear to be happening.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
When I recognize that and I can let go of those thoughts, I may not change the actual what is happening. Like, you know, I could let go of my thoughts about the politics in this country and, you know, what's going on with all the election and whatever. That's not going to change those things that are happening. What it's going to do is make me then look at, oh, if I dislike this guy because he lies all the time, how am I lying? You know, where are my lies? And not to be looking for my guilt, but to be looking for the places where I think I'm fooling myself about what's going on, or I think I'm fooling you about what's going on, and really look at them and quit lying to myself about what is going on. Quit lying to God about what I'm doing, you know, and just quit it. And start, you know, recognizing that whatever is happening is here for my best interests. What could I not accept? And now let me look at that and see what it says about me, what my thoughts are saying about me. And if my thoughts are saying that I think I'm a victim, then, you know, who's trying to hurt me? I have to look at who I think is trying to hurt me and recognize that that's not what's happening. and let them off the hook. And when I can do that, I can look at this enemy, quote unquote, and see that he is wholly worthy of forgiveness, that he is completely innocent. When I can do that, that's how I see my own whole worthiness of forgiveness. That's how I see my own innocence. Otherwise, as long as I'm pointing guilt everywhere, that's all I'm going to see. So it really is it's your own thinking that brings you to it. shall we go on to the answer?
Sure.
So the person's saying, you know, I've had trouble getting a job. I don't know if I want to work. I think that, you know, I can't tell the difference between the ego and the Holy Spirit and what they're telling me about what I should be doing. And, believe me, I go the same way. So, the answer says, discerning between the ego and the Holy Spirit can be a daunting task at times. And yet one of the most important, if not the most important, to master in your study of A Course in Miracles. Until such time comes as your certainty that all your thoughts and actions come from the Holy Spirit or the real world, the best one can do is do the best one can do and then observe the fruits of one's labor, or as the Course would call it, the test of truth. And from chapter 14, section 11, from the Course in Miracles, the test of truth, he says, you have one test, as sure as God, by which to recognize if what you learned is true. If you are wholly free of fear of any kind, and if all those who meet or even think of you share in your perfect peace, then you can be sure that you have learned God's lesson and not your own. Well, that's pretty easy, right?
Well, that would seem to be daunting, you know, if we take it from where we think we are. But if we just moment to moment just look at each individual fearful thought and fearful belief and fearful idea, that, you know, oftentimes those come up around work and, you know, finances and the whole, it's all interconnected, you know, it ties into our relationships with other people, it ties into our thoughts and feelings about, you know, where we live and, you know, the whole gamut of stuff. So it's not like it's just an isolated thing. It's this thought system really, the two thought systems that we're talking about here impact everything. So the ones, you know, at once, it seems, you know, the ones, once we get to, once we get to a place where we recognize that each moment can become an opportunity to switch our minds focus from the thought system of ego to the thought system of the Holy Spirit, then every moment becomes an opportunity to be in that classroom, which is undoing the fear. And as we do that, we help everyone else. I thought it was interesting. I never thought of this until you read this again, which I remember reading this, and this is one of the, you know, one of many potent paragraphs in the Course. It's from chapter 14, section 6, paragraph 5 in the text. I'll just read it again. The test of truth. You have one test as sure as God by which to recognize if what you learned is true. If you are wholly free of fear of any kind, and if all those who meet or even think of you share in your perfect peace, then you can be sure that you have learned God's lesson, not your own. You know what occurred to me is, in a sense, the way we normally think about ourselves, we have no way of knowing what, quote, other people think about us. But turning it around, we certainly know what we think about other people. So, I mean, I think maybe a corollary to this could be that if we think, meet or even think of anyone and don't experience perfect peace, that could be a clue that we have inner work to do. That, you know, if there's anyone who pushes our buttons, you know, anyone that seems to be outside of us that we find is the cause of our victimhood or, you know, the cause of anything less than perfect peace for us, then we can be sure that we have not learned God's lesson and instead have been learning our own, meaning our ego's own. So that I think becomes a very pragmatic approach to it, doesn't it? Because we can see that any time that we're not perfectly peaceful, we've obviously chosen the wrong teacher and can choose once again.
Yeah, that would seem pretty darn simple, wouldn't it? And yeah. But you know, when do I get to that place where I say, oh, you know, I must have decided wrongly because I'm not at peace. You know, usually that's when everything's already gone wrong. But that's okay, because you then can, you know, you can use that as a classroom. You know, when you see the results of your mistakes, you don't have to run off in despair and say, oh man, I screwed it up again. You know, you really can just say, all right, you know, thanks for showing me, you know, the error of this particular thought. And, now I don't want to make that error anymore. Mm-hmm, it's pretty simple. And in what I was just quoting from chapter 5, what is it that Jesus says is the purpose or the reason why I might not be feeling wholly joyous is because I've reacted with a lack of love to one of God's creations. And so, right then and there, he says, you know, if you're feeling crappy, you know, here's why. You know, it's pretty simple. So just, you know, look at how you feel. Here you have a sign. It's not even a cryptic sign. It's not a sign that's written in Sanskrit or something. It's a sign that is completely coherent with your life. You know, you see it in your everyday life, everything that you do. And so, you know, all you have to do is just look. How do I feel? And, you know, that's what he says. If you wonder if it's working, if you wonder if it's right, how do you feel? And if you're feeling peaceful and joyful and not afraid and not scarce and all that, you know what? Then you're doing it right. And, you know, if you're not, then try again. You know, it's pretty simple.
It is. And I think I would also suggest that, you know, sometimes we can have sensations in our bodies that don't align with you know, what we call perfect peace. But recognizing that those are in our minds and it's our interpretation of those, you know, so it really affects everything, including what we think of as our, not only our financial health, but our material health as seemingly separate selves. You know, the whole principle applies to everything equally, and you know, it becomes a way to you know, generalize and to look at everything that isn't perfect peace is obviously something that we've you know, made it an incorrect choice that doesn't call for condemnation. It just calls for letting go of our seemingly individual choice, or sick for short. Realize there's an acronym there. and just saying, okay, well, that didn't work. So, you know, the other alternative must be to let go of, you know, what didn't work and allow what's behind that, the real alternative to you know, enter my mind and choose that instead. And we all have access to that. And I think it just takes practice to remember that it's not hidden. It's just that we've hidden from us. You know, we were talking about earlier, that we're not afraid of self. You know, we're not afraid of crucifixion. We're afraid of salvation or redemption. You know, and because we think that somehow if we let go of our fear, that something will go wrong, but the thing that appeared to have gone wrong really is having chosen the thought system of fear in the first place. So,
yeah, and when you recognize that, how simple it is, it just seems too good to be true. Honestly, it just seems, how can that be, that it's so simple? But really, it is. It's just as easy as that. Is just looking at, you know, oh, what am I doing? Oh, help me, help me, Oprah Winfrey. Help me, Holy Spirit.
Is Oprah Winfrey the new Obi-Wan Kenobi?
Oh, I'm thinking of Ricky Bobby. I don't know if you know that movie, Talladega Nights, but
oh, okay.
anyway, if you don't, then it's moot. But he thinks he's having a terrible problem, and he's panicking, and he's saying, "Help me, God, help me, Oprah Winfrey." So that's the new Holy Spirit, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway. okay. Where are we? I'm all carried away here. So the one test of truth is probably, you know, this is the, you could, you know, I could tattoo that on my arm. I'm always looking for something to tattoo on my arm. That's the one kind of thing that you could always remember. You know, if I'm not in holy, in perfect peace, then something went wrong.
Right. And we don't have to analyze it. We just have to look at the contents of our mind, say, am I completely peaceful? And if we're not, then we obviously are, you know, we've picked up the sword of the ego, and we're out thrashing around, you know, severing what never was divided in our mind, and, you know, isolating ourselves from the peace that we in truth can't ever leave. But on the dream screen of the mind, we can thrash around and be swashbucklers and pretend to be, you know, fighting against all kinds of imaginary foes. But they're just dream figures. Yeah.
And the thing is that if I am actually doing that, then I have completely lost my mind. I'm looking to a cause that doesn't exist for a symptom that doesn't exist. And instead of looking at the symptom and saying, this cannot be, and so let me look for the true cause of it. The true cause of it isn't because, you know, I'm worried about global warming, or I don't like the politics, or you know, so that's not the cause. You know, that's where to come to the point where we recognize the actual cause of our problems is not what's happening in the world. The actual solution to our problems is not to change anything in this world, even though it seems like that is expedient at the time. You know, well, maybe I better go get a job because, you know, I don't want to sleep under the bridge. Maybe I better, whatever, you know, lock the doors because, you know, strangers may come in my house at night. You know, whatever it is I'm doing. And that's, just think about that. You know, why do we lock our doors? If we completely believed this course completely and wholly, then we wouldn't believe anything in this world, no matter what it appeared. And so, you know, if it truly is that, and this is the, I guess, the key metaphysical thing in this course that we're studying right now is, what is the world? And if there is no world, and that's a key, central thought of this course, that this world is not anything, it's not true, then I can't look to it for cause. I can't look to something that doesn't exist for the cause of my suffering. And the only place I can look is in my own mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so once I start doing that and seeing, oh, you know, I made that up. I'm the one who said that things should be this way. I'm the one who imagined that if I didn't have a new car this year, things were going to go terrible. I'm the one who made up the story that, you know, I better go, you know, I've had a headache 2 days in a row. Maybe I have a brain tumor. I'm the one who's making up these stories and believing them every single time. And that's the cause. It was my favorite thing. I play this with Ken all the time. He says, the one thing that you can know in this world for sure, that you are the dreamer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that, I think that what you just said a moment ago kind of triggered a recognition that how we get to where we know we're the dreamer is by bringing the contents of the dream back to the mind. And I think that's where, you know, another one of Ken's brilliant comments on Freud actually was about Freud's dream analysis, and how he said, you know, Freud suggested that the, you know, the dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. Well, you know, what Ken said, well, to extrapolate on that and recognize that the waking dream that we call everyday life, as the Course would put it, is also that royal road. And so we can use everything, literally everything that appears to be happening in the world as a way to get back to the mind. And again, using the simple test is, am I at peace about the specifics of the circumstance that I think that I'm in at any given moment? And if we can say, I'm at peace with this, then we can be sure we've learned God's lesson and not our own. then we know that we're using the classroom in the way it was intended to be used, which is the undoing of the ego's thought system. And essentially we wove that that thread of undoing into every thread that the ego made. The thread that works backwards is kind of like taking a string into the cave, you know, and tying one end to a tree outside the cave kind of thing, you know, so we can trace our way back. I think that's how, in a sense, we've all appeared to have gone down different caves, and so we each have our individual strings that are, you know, get darker and darker as we go down ego's path into the labyrinth or the cave or whatever. But it's in another one of the metaphors in one of Ken's audios is that, you know, that same thread sort of worked backwards with the Holy Spirit at the helm instead of the ego becomes a golden thread that glows brighter and brighter as we get closer to the mouth of the cave and back into daylight. And I think that's a pretty cool metaphor because, you know, we really can use every single moment and every single thing that seems to happen to us to recognize it's really coming from us. And to get back to our mind, reel it back in, saying this is not about the other person or the other persons or the environment or the whatever that I seem to be experiencing. This is about a projection of my mind. And if I'm not at peace, that interpretation of that projection is false, and it's essentially irrelevant to the reality of what I am, and the reality of what we all are as the same being becomes revealed more and more as we uncover and undo the barriers that we've put in front of it, which is the ego thought system. So, do you want to read the second paragraph, Lynn?
Sure. Okay. So, while you have experienced forgiveness in various areas of your life, it seems incomplete with regard to employment, due in part to your seeming ambivalence towards it. Before you can become aware of what the Holy Spirit would have you do or not do, you must be willing to hide nothing. And a quote from chapter 15, you will not be able to accept perfect communication as long as you would hide it from yourself, for what you would hide is hidden from you. In your practice, then, try only to be vigilant against deception and seek not to protect the thoughts you would keep to yourself. Oh, my Lord. Okay, let the Holy Spirit's purity shine them away and bring all your awareness to the readiness for purity he offers you. So that's chapter 15, section 4, paragraph 9. Wow, what an amazing thing. You know, stop lying to yourself. You know, when I realized, oh my gosh, you know, I am fooling myself. I'm literally fooling myself, and I questioned, how could I be fooling my own self? And I looked at all the ways that I deceived myself in my own mind to soothe myself, to convince myself of something, to imagine, oh well, maybe this will happen or that will happen. You know, I have all these ways to lie to myself about what's happening and then, you know, blame, you know, the universe or God or whatever for the result. So, I mean, this is brilliant and so right on. Even if it wasn't Jesus, whoever is saying these things is just in my mind. I mean, have you been looking at my thoughts? Have you been looking at the way I talk to myself? Oh my God, Jesus, do you know me? It's amazing. So, continuing on with the paragraph. In other words, examine all the thoughts you hold in your mind regarding employment or anything else. Make a list of good and bad, for and against. Just let whatever is in there come into your conscious awareness. Once all the chatter about this topic has been voiced, then you are more able to hear the big voice, which will guide you. You will find that your focus on the answer and form will recede as the content of being with or without guilt becomes more important. An exercise such as mentioned above will help you practice shifting your focus from the form to the content, from the effect to the cause. And remember, too, the important lesson Jesus teaches us about purpose. And this, again, this is from chapter 17. He says, in any situation in which you are uncertain, the first thing to consider very simply is, what do I want to come of this? What is it for? The clarification of the goal belongs at the beginning, for it is this which will determine the outcome. In the ego's procedure, this is reversed. The situation becomes the determiner of the outcome, which can be anything. The reason for this disorganized approach is evident. The ego does not know what it wants to come of the situation. It is aware of what it does not want, but only that. It has no positive goal at all. And that's text chapter 17, section 6, paragraph 2. But now, the answer continues, you have a definite goal, and by making room within your mind to hear the gentle guidance of the Holy Spirit, you are ensured of reaching that goal. That's the end of the answer. That's the perfect answer, right? Is mm-hmm. when whatever is happening, no matter how mundane it is, you know, whether it's, you know, me, you know, waking up in the morning and going to make coffee, you know, what is the goal? What is the purpose? You know, why do I robotically get up every day and, you know, go downstairs and make a cup of coffee? Because I think I need it. I think I need the caffeine. I like the taste of it. I have all these goals.
What is it for?
Yeah. What is it for? But do I ever ask, you know, what really am I doing, you know, standing here in the kitchen waiting for water to heat up so I can have coffee?
Right.
You know, it's everything.
Yeah, and we can really, you know, over time generalize this to ask that question about everything we appear to be involved in the world. And, you know, whether it's brushing our teeth or hopping in the car to do an errand or, tidying up the garage or, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter what we're doing. If we can just say, well, why am I doing this? Years ago, I was, had a short, mini career, I guess you could call it, as a process improvement consultant after a friend of mine gave me a stack of books and said, if you can read these and understand what's going on and apply these and over the next month, I think I can get you a job as a process improvement consultant working for the Air Force, you know. And so, okay, sure. So I needed some work. In my mind, I needed some work at the time, you know, tying into the subject here. And so I did that discovered that the what is it for question surfaced in a really interesting way, and that I was studying the Toyota manufacturing process, which is basically learning how to make things, in this case cars, and in the case of the Air Force where I was doing the consulting, you know, all the processes for maintaining aircraft and you know, all the other just administrative processes and tax desks that, you know, any organization has or any individual has, you know, you can apply this to. But the way that Toyota manufacturing folks worked it is they had a system called five whys. They would ask, well, why are we building this assembly this way, or, you know, what? And you know, it kind of gets back to if you keep asking deeper questions, you know, why do I do that? Well, why do I do that? And if you keep, you know, getting deeper and deeper into the why, eventually you know. The number really is important, although they chose five as kind of an arbitrary suggestion, just to, you know, keep going deeper until you get to something that triggers an aha moment, and you can you know, tremendously change things for the better. And this has very practical applications too. But I think that even generalizing it further than just a manufacturing process improvement approach to things, we could use that process improvement on our mind and look at how we can keep asking ourselves why we're doing things, not in any kind of condemning way, but just in a very observant, gently observant way to ask why we're doing the things we're doing, and wait until we get to the one of two thought systems. And if we're doing it out of fear instead of out of love, then it's like, okay, well, I've achieved the purpose of this exercise. I now see that if I'm doing something motivated by fear, which if we're honest with ourselves, a lot of our work is, and even our play, what we think of as play, you know, that because those distinctions really, you know, are arbitrary. But because we think that we're getting something as egos out of the process or the task or the activity that we're involved in. And if we can just kind of look at those things and say, well, I could actually choose a different purpose for this. And the different purpose would be to see peace in everything, that we appear to be doing in the world, and recognizing that it's not in the world, that it's back in the mind. And so the seeing peace really becomes an exercise in returning the world to our mind where it truly never left. And that's why I think Ken Wapnick rightly says, you know, you can't get too far from the metaphysics of the Course, because, you know, one of the fundamental premises is ideas do not leave their source. You know, they leave not their source. So if that's true, then everything that we experience really is in the mind. And that revelation is hugely helpful, because that removes the victimhood from anything and everything. If it's no longer outside me, the decision of whether or not to be peaceful, and it's not predicated or contingent in any way on what happens or doesn't happen to me or my body or my alleged world here, then that's tremendously liberating, because that means that the locus of control is not scattered about in a world that I have no control over. It's always and only in my mind. And that's hugely transformative, isn't it?
It is. It's a joyful, joyful, joyful thought. You know, once you get that, you cannot help but be happy. Because, hang on just a second. Because, you know, you've recognized that there's the cause of guilt. The actual cause of guilt does not exist. And really all those things, when we're talking about, you know, why we should or would or what, everything that we think that we need to do in this world, we think we need to do because we believe in our own guilt. Mm-hmm. And we believe that we have, we have through our own power of our mind, you just sent me something else. Good. The power of our own mind. We believe in the power of our own mind. Mm-hmm. Think about superstition. Think of, you know, when you say, oh, I shouldn't have said that, or, you know, don't mention that, or don't think about that. You know, we're superstitiously trying to, make something happen or not make something happen, through our wishing, through our hoping, through our, and then when bad things occur, we blame ourselves and we say, you know, always because, you know, I was thinking about this, or because we think we can curse people. We think we can bless people. We think that we can do things to change or make the outcome of what happens in any situation through our own mind. When we say, think good thoughts now because, you know, I'm really hoping I get that job. Wish me well. You know, we're asking people to use the power of their mind to affect an outcome in the world. So we obviously have a belief in the power of our own mind, but we don't really know the power of our own mind. And so the belief and the power that we're giving here is the power of the ego. It's not the power of the true mind. These are all ego imaginations about what is happening, what did happen, what will happen, what can happen, and how it is that I'm affecting it. And even to the point, and, you know, I'm going to stick my neck out here because I know that this may or may not be wildly accepted here, but even to the point that we believe that we're responsible for the earth. I believe that I'm responsible for global warming. I'm using electricity here that's burning coal. You know, I think I'm responsible for, you know, the melting of the ice caps. And I'm thinking I personally am responsible for all these things and not recognizing that this world is a script. It has an outcome. Things happen in it. That's the purpose of the script, is to make a story that engages me and keeps me involved. So when I'm looking at the global warming, what am I not looking at? When I'm looking at whose fault it is that these things are happening, what am I not looking at? This is, you know, we accuse politicians of doing this all the time, you know, redirecting our attention to something other than what they're doing wrong so that we don't, you know, that they don't get in trouble. And yet I'm doing it every day when I'm deflecting my responsibility for this world. And calling it a disaster. And
that's brilliant, Lynn. Yeah, that's really quite brilliant what you're just saying, because I think, you know, we think of, you know, political cover-ups and, you know, media deception and yada yada. And, well, yeah, it's just a reflection of the big cover-up, which is the idea that, you know, it pun intended, it trumps 9/11 and any other, you know, conspiracy in the world, in that the big conspiracy, the big deception, the big diversion of attention is to the world. And we've talked about this on a number of occasions, and how I think it's lesson 136, it's sickness is a defense against the truth. About several paragraphs down, it talks about the double shield of oblivion. We haven't talked about this for a while, but I think this one, a really neat concept in the Course, that suggests that the world is actually the outer shield of oblivion, which is really basically everything having to do with time and space and bodies and matter and energy, you know, from quarks to quasars to, you know, the whole galactic cosmos and universe that we think we're in, and it's just a tiny part of, which our senses, you know, faithfully reflect that to us. Everywhere we look, we see this big world outside. I mean, I can look out and I see an ocean out my window right now. It's like, that looks pretty big, you know, and I don't even see just the tiniest part of it. But the outer shield of oblivion is designed so that we think of ourselves as weak and ineffectual and at the mercy of, instead of being merciful, at the mercy of this world, where in truth, you know, we made up the world as a defense against the truth. But that's only the outer shield of oblivion. The inner shield is the whole thought system of sin, guilt, fear. That's the insanity of thinking that, you know, there was a problem in the first place that required or precipitated the need to, seemingly have this prodigal escape from the problem of having made up duality, having made up this belief in separation. And that's at a level so far, you know, out of our normal awareness that, you know, we really do need everything in the world as a reminder to get back to the mind. And it's only through a consistent and steady, patient, gentle practice with ourselves, and, you know, watching every condemning thought of anyone else, whether it's a politician or somebody behind the scenes playing dirty tricks and manipulating the media and playing on people's baser natures and you know, lack of dedication to get to the quote real story unquote, you know, all that stuff. I mean, I've been watching my mind, looking at, you know, documentaries about things like that lately, and it's like, wow, you know, it's all that stuff is, you know, that outer shield is really of oblivion is really just a way to get back to the inner shield of, as you said very eloquently, Lynn, you know, what's in my mind that really needs to be looked at, and without condemnation, without heaping more guilt and on it, and putting the proverbial carrot on fire kind of thing. Because if we can just look at ego's insanity, and look at that wanting to deceive, that wanting to hide from truth, without condemning ourselves and saying, "Wow, we thought there was actually justification for being afraid, but that whole premise was faulty. The unconscious guilt was also unfounded." And once we get through the outer shield of oblivion to the inner shield of the mind, look at the ego mind and see that it's not working out for us. That inner shield of oblivion, then we go past that ego defense and realize that there's nothing to defend. The whole thing was a sham. The not only that was the emperor naked, but there was no emperor, and and that's kind of cool. I mean, but that's not how the emperor looks at it, and so we have to kind of anticipate the backlash of the ego emperors to not get blindsided by it. But eventually we get enough of those experiences under our belt, and we say, okay, I now have what I need to deal with this, which is the mercy of the Holy Spirit that really undoes the mercilessness of the ego, which is basically feeling that we're at the mercy of the world, and we're at the mercy of alleged others and what other people do or don't do, or no matter how seemingly close or far they are from us in the world or other worlds. It could be, we might feel persecuted by extraterrestrials someday.
That's right. I'm feeling persecuted by it right now, even thinking about them, because they're going to come and attack me. So I'm worried about it.
My wife and I have been watching this mini series that my brother told me about called Salvation, which is about the cover up of an asteroid that's about to hit the Earth, and the plot within upper government circles to steal some uranium to work on this high tech venture to essentially blow up the asteroid. But then they discovered, well, that's going to make it so that the asteroid still hits the Earth, but now it wipes out all kinds of places and little places rather than one big place, which is basically the same. And anyway, it's just kind of this whole thing of how to deal with non-existent problems, And as Ken Wapnick points out, it's the ego is a maladaptive solution to a non-existent problem. And the maladaptive solution, of course, is the world. And then the non-existent problem is the sin, guilt, fear in our mind that we thought required an external solution in order to hide from it, which of course never really works, because there's always light peeking through the cracks in the ego's defenses. No matter how dark and gloomy the ego makes it, there's always a little spark somewhere that kind of is in the screen of our minds and says, "Oh, hey, look over here," but it doesn't even say anything. It's just this quiet awareness that says, when you're done, being distracted by the shields of oblivion, you can notice that there's a little glimmer of light that can be explored, and the more you look that way, the more you realize, well, as I get closer to that and bring the darkness in my mind to that, the darkness disappears. It never really was there. So I put in the chat window another FAQ that's kind of related to this. Since I've just kind of Googled through the facimoutreach.org site, there's a way you can look up different topics, and there's a whole bunch of stuff about work. We could probably spend another month or two talking about just these FAQs. So, does 74 sound like a good one to you?
Yeah, it's great. And why don't you read the question? Okay. I'll post the link in the room. So
okay.
And this is question number 74, which is early on when they were doing these. This must have.
yeah. Well, there's over 1,300 of them, so this is one of the first 100 or so. So this question 74 from facimoutreach.org says, "I read in Absence from Felicity," which is a great book if you haven't read it, about how Helen used shopping as a defense against Jesus. It almost totally preoccupied her and succeeded in keeping Jesus safely away from her attention. Sound familiar, anyone? My work and commitments are doing the same for me. Well, we could also use it in the converse way. We could say that, you know, not working or feeling guilty about not working or, you know, it doesn't matter. The ego will turn anything into a problem. So whether it's overworked or underworked or over success or under success, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, the ego can turn any situation into an excuse for not being at peace, right? Because it doesn't know peace. Okay, so my work and commitments are doing the same for me. Although I never thought I was using them as a defense, only being normal. Can this be avoided? Okay, here we go.
Can this be avoided? And you know, I guess, yeah, as you pointed out, there are so many ways that we avoid the truth. And, you know, it seems so simple. Well, yeah, just stop it. But, you know, it's not that easy to do when you're convinced in your mind that what happens to you in this world has consequences.
Right.
And so it's, you know, coming to recognize that there, again, as yesterday's lesson, I'm in danger nowhere in this world. There's nothing can harm a son of God. And so why am I afraid? Because I don't know I'm a son of God. I don't remember I'm a son of God. I don't remember anything about that stuff. And so I think I am this being that is so small and helpless and vulnerable. And I have a reason to be afraid. If I don't know what I am, I have every reason to be afraid. You should be afraid. If you think you're this ego thing, it's terrifying. And you should be afraid because you are in danger. But the truth is you're not.
I was just going to say, the ego's mantra is, be afraid, be very afraid.
Be very afraid.
But that's, I mean, not in so many subtle, not in so many ways, but, you know, sometimes it's more subtle than that, sometimes it's blatant, but, you know, it's, but no matter what it is, if that's the end result, then we know which teacher we're listening to, don't we?
Exactly. And if you're in fear, I don't care what situation you're in, you can always look at it and see where the fearful things are happening. Even in the most joyous situation, you know, you and I have anyway recognized, you know, I'm constantly on alert, always, you know, looking for what can go wrong, you know, trying to make sure everything is okay, trying to ensure safety for myself and those around me, because I truly do believe in danger. And so, you know, I think there is a reason that I shouldn't be, you know, standing at the top of a precipice because, you know, maybe I could fall. But, you know, that is giving power to something that doesn't even really exist. So let me go ahead and start reading the answer to this question. You know, how can I avoid using anything as a defense? So the answer, a major focus of the teaching and training of the course is to get us to think in terms of purpose. I think we were seeing that before. What do I want to come of this? What is it for? From text chapter 17. The test of everything on earth is simply this. What is it for? The answer makes it what it is for you. It has no meaning of itself. Yet you can give reality to it according to the purpose that you serve. And that's from text chapter 24, section 7, paragraph 6. So that what is it for? What is the purpose I'm given to things? That really is the actual answer. Once I see that, you know, I don't have to, you know, there's no place else to go. You know, I see it in my own mind. There it is. And oh my gosh, you know, the purposes that I give to people and things and, what a crazy imagination I have. There are only two purposes that are open to choice in our minds. Either we have chosen to reinforce our belief in separation or to undo this belief. And there is never an instant when we are not making this choice. Never an instant when we're not making that choice. Right this very instant, I am making this choice.
Yep.
Another way of stating this is that we are always choosing either to push the love of Jesus away or join with it. This means that it is never the activity that we are engaged in that is the problem or the reason we're not peaceful. It is the choice we are making to use the activity to keep us separate or in conflict. So that, what is it for? You know, ask of all things, what is it for? Even the simplest thing, what is it for? You know, it'll show you the deceptions in your mind, and you know, the decision that to not fool myself anymore is a huge decision when it comes to you know, coming to realizing the actual cause of what's happening, the actual purpose that I'm giving to you. Whenever I see you and whenever I hear from you, the motives that I make up, the ego that I make up, when I begin to realize that all of those things, the words which I made up in my mind, gave a judgment to, decided I was good or bad, and therefore defined you from ideas in my own mind, and basically unjustly accuse you of being something that you're not. And as long as I continue to do that, then I can never see my own innocence. As long as all I see is guilt, then all I'm going to see is guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a decision to, first off, look at the stories that I make up. Look at the thoughts that I have in my mind that I've defined you with. And the motive that I've accused you of having, and that motive is you are trying to kill me. You don't want me. You don't like me. You think I'm bad. These are all the motives that we give to another, even though it may not be conscious at all. We think we're being loving. And as long as we're seeing people in that way, then, again, we can never see our own innocence. But when I strip away those motives, those ideas, those thoughts, those stories I made up, and get to back down to the truth of what's there, I see that you're wholly worthy of forgiveness. I see that you are innocent. You didn't do any of those things. I put that false nose on you as the witch in Monty Python. Anyway.
That's good. I forgot about that set. That's good, yeah.
But that's it. You know, once I recognize that I was the one who did that and I stop, then I see you didn't do anything at all. Yeah. And neither did I.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's very liberating, isn't it? When we recognize how we have, you know, basically made up, you know, a whole world in order to evade, attention from, you know, what things are really for, that we use the very things that seem to populate our world as the ways to get back to the mind, and asking that question, not to get like a specific answer, but in terms of, well, it's, you use it, you know, X for Y and yada yada. It really, I think the intent of the question is, of what is it for, is which thought system is it for? Which thought system am I going to use to interpret the purpose of anything? And if we, you know, trust the wisdom of the Course, that there's really only two, and on a horizontal level, there appear to be infinite number of reasons or purposes for things, just because that's the ego's fragmentation. But in truth, to get out of duality, we just have to ask, is this for the purpose of maintaining the illusion of duality, the illusion of separation, or is this for the purpose of undoing it? And eventually, the dream of it, the purpose for furthering the illusion, is seen as part of the illusion, and we just let that go ultimately too. But while we think we're in the world, it's helpful, I think, to use duality against itself. In other words, just basically look at the choice in our mind as an opportunity to choose against the idea that we need to choose ultimately. Should I read the next paragraph?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. The Course teaches that we made the world to be a distraction and a smokescreen so that we would forget entirely that we have a mind that at every instant is choosing to identify with egos or the Holy Spirit's thought system. We become preoccupied with our work, our families, instead of never realizing the underlying purpose that has been chosen in our minds. We justify our immersion in our lives in the world by saying, everyone does that, or it's normal. Both of those short phrases and quotes. But it is all very purposeful, as reflected in this statement. Every special relationship you have made has, as its fundamental purpose, the aim of occupying your mind so completely that you will not hear the call for truth. And that's from the text, chapter 17, section 4, paragraph 3, sentence 3. Okay, we, of course, are not aware that this is going on, which is why the Course is so helpful. So in a sense, you know, earlier you were talking about something that reminded me of those virtual reality helmets. If you haven't seen those, they're this sort of a little headset that covers, you know, it's a helmet that has a screen in front of it so that your virtual reality experience is more immersive rather than just, you know, looking at a computer screen and that you can walk away from. This headset is something you can wear around, you know, and as you turn your head, it goes, you know, it tracks with you. 'Cause
right, yeah.
You've got the sound and the visuals and I suppose the other three senses will be along shortly kind of thing. But you know, the whole idea is that, you know, that's just a microcosm of the bigger, macrocosm of the dream of the ego, which we made to keep us, asleep and deceived and diverted in terms of our mind's attention. Because the ego doesn't want to be undone. The ego doesn't want to have its naked emperor ruse exposed. You know, doesn't want to see that there's not only, you know, no clothes but no emperor, you know, because that's really the process that we're engaged in here as we look at the contents of our mind. We realize
that
whole premise is flawed. The whole premise that the world is real and our experience in it is inevitable, and as victims of it, and all we have to do is just question that and say, wait a minute, what if what the folks in Copenhagen discovered, that mind can no longer be left out of the equation, and even in what we think of as physics, if that's true, and mind is primary and not secondary, then it changes everything. It really changes everything.
So. Absolutely, it does. And you were talking about that incredible, those VR helmets. Actually, when you put one of those things on, you know, you do have, it is an experience like as if you were actually there in whatever it is that it's showing you. Because our visual cues are just so strong. What we see with our eyes really does make up a reality for us. And so you can be very convinced by something in a VR helmet. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's what it is exactly what we are right now. It's like we are in a VR helmet. And because, you know, it's my knees don't see the world. My toes don't see the world. You know,
well, maybe they do. Maybe they do. How do we know?
Well, I don't know. I'd be like little toe eyes on the end of my toes. But yeah, so we actually are in that situation. And whatever it is that we appear to be experiencing, as, you know, Jesus implies here with this, that it's here to occupy my mind. And it's here to divert my attention from the truth of reality. And when we talk about the ego and you know, it's fitting its purpose, doing what its purpose is, that is the ego's purpose, is to divert my attention. We made it that way. We made this ego so that we would not remember the truth about what we are. And its job is to prevent us from remembering it. It's doing its job very well. The ego cannot be faulted for not doing what we made it to do.
I hadn't thought of it that way, but yeah, that's true. It's,
well, I mean,
well, if it's a nothing thought system, then that's, I think, part of the secret, if you will, is to not condemn what doesn't exist. Just look at it without condemnation. Yeah.
Right. And because you give it a reality when you condemn it. And, mm-hmm. But when you look at it and you recognize this thing, this is a system, and it's just like if you went to, and I haven't done this for a while, but, like you go to these, they are virtual reality. You get inside of a kind of a thing, and it's like a ride at the fair or something. And, you know, it gives you the illusion that you're in, you know, skiing in the Alps or something. But the truth is you're inside of a booth in a carnival. So, but you're having an experience that appears to be real. And if that machine broke down and all of a sudden the visuals were not there, then you would recognize, oh, I'm inside of a machine. I'm inside of something that is not real, and I can mm-hmm. step out of it. Mm-hmm. But the ego is so, you know, well written. I mean, we did a good job when we made it, that it doesn't break down. You know, it will continue to show you these untruths over and over. Even when you're recognizing that they're not true, it still will continue to present you with all these stories about things that are not true, because that is its job.
Yeah.
And my job is to not believe it. Mm-hmm. Not believe what it's giving me, not believe what it's telling me. And I can do that without harming it. I can do that without, you know, breaking this mechanism, or, you know, making it, you know, afraid for its life. I can actually coerce it into helping me to remember my truth, by making it my servant instead of me being its servant. And Jesus tells us that in chapter 4. He says, you know, you can have an actual humble ego, believe it or not. It can be trained to become humble, and then it becomes helpful. And that's really the only way that we're going to get, we're not going to get out of this by fighting the ego and thinking it's evil and trying to run away from it and trying to disarm it. We're really only going to get out of this by recognizing, hey, I made you and I gave you the power that you have. And I no longer need your services. And now I have another, you know, power that's here for me, the Holy Spirit. And, you know, kindly step out of the way. And, you know, if you're not going to help me, then, you know, go away. But, you know, we made it for a purpose, and that purpose can be changed. So, you know, don't fight it. Don't run away from it. Just recognize, you know, I'm the one that gave it all the power it has. That's
step
it.
Away from the identity vehicle and no one will get hurt.
Exactly.
Shall I read the next paragraph?
Yeah, go ahead and read the next paragraph.
Okay. In view of this, your question regarding of how to avoid work or anything else as a defense against the love of Jesus, in a sense, is the wrong question or focus. As the above quote indicates, that is the very purpose of our being in the world with all of our obligations and commitments, to be preoccupied with what is outside our minds so that we will forget entirely that we have a mind that is choosing at every instant. In that sense, then, we can't avoid using the world as a defense because that is why we are here. So what would help you most is simply to be honest about this as your underlying intention in being busy. The purpose is not what you think, just as Jesus informs us in Lesson 5, that we are never upset for the reason we think. Helen knew this clearly. She knew that her shopping was a way of keeping Jesus away. If you can be clear about that, the problem will not be worsened by guilt over the dishonesty. Being afraid to get close to love is not sinful. Therefore, shame and guilt are not justified. Fear is not a sin, and it has no effect on Jesus' love for you. There's the, you don't have to earn it or learn it. Our worth is, and our innocence is a given. Okay. When Helen knew she was ready to accept Jesus' love, her experience was that he told her she didn't have to go shopping anymore, and there was no sense of sacrifice. She was always clear about the purpose of what she was doing. That is what we all need to aim for. We are never busy for the reason we think. Okay, there we go.
That's cute, and it's true. You could exchange that for anything. I'm never
fill in the blank for the reason I think.
Yeah. For the reason I think, yeah, never.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, it's certainly using the ego's premise as the never whatever for the reason we think. You know, that's a pretty good classroom aid, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's interesting that, you know, the question is about Helen and her shopping, but it could be about anything. It could be, you know, Lynn and her, you know, addiction to Facebook or, you know, whatever it is, you know, it's either the purpose to prevent me from seeing the truth or the purpose to let me see the truth. So it's always a decision. And, I think it was in this answer, that kind of implied the answer to how the tiny mad idea ever happened. You know, and Jesus says, why do you ask how it happened? Because you're doing it all the time. we are constantly making the same choice as the tiny mad idea and deciding, do I want to see this with love or do I want to see this in fear? You know, that's really what happens. So it's the decision to constantly decision to see with the Holy Spirit and to laugh at the ego, to really look at what the ego is trying to present to us in terms of, you know, gifts of the world and to not accept any single one of them as being true. You know, whether it's, my granddaughter's smile or, you know, soldiers being killed in Afghanistan, you know, to accept that every single one of it is equally untrue. And I can't pick and choose which of it I want to believe and reject the rest. That is a thought system that either you believe wholly, completely, or not at all. And Jesus is not saying, you know, you pick one or the other. He's saying either you do or you don't. Either you get it or you don't. Either you see that this world is not real or you believe it's real. There's no in between of any of this stuff. And so, you know, recognizing that you can't, there's no wiggle room here. Either I accept that, you know, that, you know, what I see is a story that I made up and that none of it could possibly be true. If God is real, this could not be, you know, either I accept that completely. And if I accept that completely, then all these other things fall away. I have no need to do anything. And I need do nothing really is the correct expression of that. You know, when I accept that everything is just happening, whether I'm involved in it or not, in fact, it's like stepping through a door where, you know, what you thought was true is on one side and reality is on the other. And there is no correlation. None at all. Nothing exists in that same way. So to step into love, to step into being awake out of fear, out of the world, it doesn't change anything that appears to be happening in the script. I'm just no longer walking around and believing that what's happening is true. I'm actually, you know, still my character may be moving on the chessboard, but I'm the person who's moving the piece. I'm not the chess piece itself. And that is what shifts. I mean, that shift is everything.
It does change everything, doesn't it? Do we have time to read the last paragraph?
Yeah, I think we do. Sure.
Okay.
I'll go ahead and read it. The correction comes when we first recognize the purpose we have chosen in our wrong minds and then ask Jesus or the Holy Spirit to help us shift our purpose. so that we would use everything as a means of undoing the separation and seeing our interests as shared with everyone else's rather than in conflict with them. The challenge is learning how to do both, how to be aware of what's going on in our minds and at the same time conscientiously fulfilling our obligations and responsibilities in the world to the best of our ability. It is possible to do this, but it takes a great deal of practice. That is what the exercises in the workbook are designed to do. We learn how to function in the world effectively while learning that we are not of the world. And that's it. The workbook lessons are the ones that take us through progressively through, you know, nothing I see means anything to, this holy instant I would give to you, be you in charge. You know, really that's it. It starts from questioning the world on day one to turning myself and my life over to the truth and the reality of the Holy Spirit and allowing him to guide all of my actions and deeds. That really is the miracle. The change of perception from belief in the world and belief that I'm the doer to allowing the Holy Spirit to be the one in charge is huge.
It is. It is. And it's sort of a chew gum and walk kind of an exercise in the sense that, you know, we think it's really complicated, but it really just means being mindful while we're doing the things in the world that we would have been doing otherwise, but doing them with a greater sense of peace and a greater sense of ease. Because we no longer make our peace contingent on what we do or don't do, what happens or doesn't happen in the world. And that changes everything. Yeah. And that's our real work, our real career is learning to forgive ourselves, for the belief that we made up a world that is, you know, victimizing us and, you know, we're at the mercy of. Instead, we can, you know, be merciful to ourselves, you know, use the same circumstance and just turn it around and become the, you know, the giver of the freedom. And that really is our true career, our true job is being mindful, while we're in the world and forgiving. So anyway, thank you, Lynn, as always. I'll post, the link to this audio and I have been catching up. I did download all the ones you sent me and I'll keep getting caught up with the posts on ACIM blog. And thanks to everyone listening and participating and most importantly for choosing peace.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much, Bruce. It's such a pleasure every week to join with
you. Likewise. Always that, yes. Have a great week.
I always learn things I didn't know before.
Oh, me too. I think it's a part of that shared interest again that you know, when we come together to share this material, we inevitably learn wonderful stuff from
exactly
beyond ourselves, but appears to be beyond ourselves. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Love you, Bruce. I'll talk
Likewise.
To you next week.
Have a great week, all. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.